This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 197 was recorded on December 12th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, which happens to be my favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. It's FOMC week, and JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq is back as our feature interview guest. Juliet will help us decode the FOMC statement, and then we'll move on to Juliet's macro outlook, and finally, we'll translate that view into actionable trading strategies. Then stay tuned for our post-game segment, when Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder will join us for a discussion about waves Credit Suisse analyst Zoltan Pozsar made this week in his piece predicting more trouble in the repo market before year's end.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500, all-time new highs. What's your take on all of this?
Well, you know, as you say, more all-time highs, and the all-time highs, of course, today were reached as a direct result of flipping from trade deal off again to trade deal on again for about the 163rd time. I don't know. I've lost track. If I look at the surface of the ocean here, what I see here, Patrick, is the melt-up is still continuing on. I don't see, just looking at the price action, that there's any reason that we should be concerned. Now, if you want something to be concerned about, the piece that's been getting all kinds of attention this week, I've lost count of how many emails we got from listeners asking us to cover it, is Zoltan Pozsar. That's the Credit Suisse analyst who used to work for the Federal Reserve, has a piece out in which he's basically predicting major fireworks in the repo market, particularly right around the end of the year, December 31st into January 2nd. He's saying that there could be another really big repo spike, bigger than the one in September. Some people are extrapolating that. What Zoltan Pozsar actually said in terms of his direct prediction is, this is going to create a problem. The only real solution to that problem is QE4, a full-on quantitative easing program from the Federal Reserve in earnest. He doesn't think the Fed is going to be willing to do that until their hand is forced. Now, he doesn't say anything in his piece about any kind of stock market crash, but Zero Hedge and other observers are interpreting his comments to say, okay, forcing the Fed's hands, what that means is there has to be some kind of risk-off event in the stock market before year end in order to bring about a change which ultimately results in QE4. Now, that is adding to what Zoltan Pozsar actually says in his article. The link to Zoltan's article and his predictions is in your research roundup. Also in your research roundup, there's a link to Jeffrey Snyder, who wrote a different article, really coming to a different set of conclusions. Jeff is looking at the same issues in the repo market and interpreting them in a different way. So Jeff's response piece in reaction to Zoltan's piece, it's all in your research roundup email. Bottom line, if you want to worry about something, are we going to see another repo tantrum in the market that potentially leads to a loss of confidence and a risk-off event before year end? I don't know the answer, but let's get Jeff Snyder from Alhambra Investments to join us in our post-game segment, and we can go deeper on that issue.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar, because we certainly had, at least on the FOMC, the first break lower, but it's been recovering since. What's your take on the next move on the dollar here?
Yeah, I think that the move lower was definitely a reaction to FOMC, and certainly it's got my attention. Now, we have not yet gotten a daily close below 96.50, and of course, we've switched over now from the December chart to the March expiry, and there's backwardation in this contract, so that means the numbers are about a half of a big handle lower than the previous numbers. But the new number to watch is 96.50. We need to not see a daily daily close below 96.50. Got kind of close there, dangerously close yesterday, but then we saw a big rebound day. So it seems like there was a panic in reaction to the FOMC statement. So far, what we're seeing now is a rebound, and I hope that rebound continues. My base case is still higher, but if we do see a daily close and particularly a weekly close below 96.50 on the March futures contract, that really is going to say to me, okay, the pattern here is really starting to look like the trend is down. Now, that won't change my long-term view that I think Jeff Snyder will eventually be proven right. We've got a dollar squeeze that's going to push the market higher over time. But if we start to see daily closes below 96.50, it tells me that this downward counter trend sell-off isn't over yet, and I'm not sure how much farther it goes. I would probably take my long positions off and wait this one out until we see a sign of reversal if that were to occur.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. How did the inventory numbers come in, and are we going to keep pushing higher at these prices?
Patrick, I think we are going to move higher from here. And the reason I say that, as I've said many times before on this show, is the inventory number is important, but what's even more important is how the market reacts to it. So let's start with inventory. It doesn't get a whole lot more bearish than this. Crude oil building 822,000 barrels. Now, that's not a super huge build by itself, but hey, it's a build in a week that most analysts were expecting a drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma saw a drawdown of 3.4 million barrels, but hold on to your seatbelt for finished products. Gasoline building 5.4 million barrels, distillates building 4.1 million barrels. So if we add up crude at 822,000, gasoline at 5.4 million, distillates 4.1 million, we've got 10 million barrels of crude oil and finished product builds net across the board this week. And that would normally be just a horribly, horribly bearish number. Imports, 6 million barrels. Exports, 3.1 million barrels. Tape action in reaction to that just horribly bearish number, straight down for a good solid hour or so, and then straight back up again, retracing most of the move down on Wednesday after inventory and closing the day just barely below the five-day moving average after retracing most of the move down. So if the market was looking, Patrick, for an excuse to dump and close down $3 on the day, this was the inventory report that gave it every excuse to do so. That's what started to happen. It only lasted a few minutes, and it started to reverse. And already, Patrick, just one day later, we didn't quite take out last week's high, Patrick, but the point is you've got crude oil prices, as we speak, higher than they were before inventory came out. And this is after we got a huge bearish surprise. So if the market was looking for an excuse to roll over and trade much lower, we got the excuse and it didn't happen. What it says to me is this market's looking for a good excuse to move higher. Maybe we haven't quite seen that excuse yet because we haven't really seen a breakout, but we have maintained above the five-day moving average really for a couple of weeks now, and it looks to me like we've got an uptrend in place. We are still navigating right here, right now, some really strong resistances. So maybe the market's still going to roll over. I think more likely we're going to break through those resistances. If we can get through them and can get a daily close above $60, I think the price rally is probably set to accelerate at that point.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because we've been pinned in this kind of 1450 to 1480 area. It looked like we were about to break out, and we're back in the dead center of this range. What's the next move for gold in your mind?
Well, Patrick, it's been a very news-driven gold market. As you remember, my prediction last week, as we were nearing the top of the price channel, as I said, look, I think this is overdone, and it's set to roll over and move back down. Sure enough, the very next day, it did exactly that, traded down considerably. But then this week on the FOMC statement, we had a significant move up in reaction to FOMC. And then this morning, we had the ECB statement where they reported higher inflation numbers than the market was expecting. That took us on an intraday basis well above the top of that price channel through that resistance line. My prediction for today's show was going to be, I don't think it's going to last. I think it's news driven. I think we're going to retrace back down into that same price channel. Well, that's already happened as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. The ECB high from this morning didn't last. I think it still has lower to go, but I will say, you know, look, this is news driven, but we've got a lot of news in the system. Maybe there's going to be more news to drive it higher. If we get a daily close, Patrick, and particularly if we get a weekly close above that channel resistance line, which right now is at about 1481, if we stay above that for a few days, you really got to start to question whether or not the 1420 target that I've been talking about is still in the cards. I still think it is, but we're getting right on the hairy edge of the top of this channel, so I'll be watching it closely.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, which has been reacting with a pretty solid pop. We're trading around the 1.90 level on the yield. What's your take? Are we going up to 2% from here?
You know, I really have to admit, Patrick, I don't have very strong conviction on this. It feels like we are headed back to 2%. But, you know, I'm in a tug of war here. I think that there are lots of very good reasons, and I want to ask Julia DeClercq about this in the feature interview. I think there's lots of very good reasons to think that the low is not in yet in Treasury yields, that we still have lower to go in yield, therefore higher to go in prices. Maybe this backing up of yields that we're getting is an entry opportunity. The question on my mind is, when does inflation hit the scene? Now, the ECB statement appears to be telling us that inflation is already making a comeback faster than some people were expecting. I want to ask Juliet what she thinks about this, because if you think inflation is not a problem, then I think you want to be long the 10-year here. If you think inflation is about to become a problem, maybe not. I really don't have strong conviction. Let's find out what Juliet thinks in the feature interview.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is JDI Research founder Julia DeClercq. So why did we invite Julia back on the show this week?
Well, Juliet is, of course, one of our favorite commentators. We love having Juliet on the program, but particularly because it's an FOMC week. I wanted to get Juliet's perspective and why Juliet. We have quite a few commentators that are qualified to talk about FOMC. Well, it's also an important ECB meeting, and it was Christine Lagarde's first ECB press conference with Christine at the helm. That's a situation that Juliet has been following very closely. So she seemed like the perfect guest to get on, and at the same time, it's been long enough since we had her on for a feature interview. It was time to bring her back. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. I did a full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, the host of this excellent podcast, back on September 7th, 2019. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. We discussed a number of key issues about the value of having a rules-based investment strategy in a portfolio. In our conversation, Niels shared some insights that may surprise you, especially when it comes to how trend following strategies don't really operate the way some market commentators suggest they do. For more information, including a free book about trend following and the accredited investor slide deck from my interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Juliet is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Well, it's FOMC week, so joining me as this week's feature interview guest is JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq. Juliet has prepared a deck of her famous graphs and charts, which are some of the best in the industry, so I definitely encourage you to download the chart book, as we'll be referring to it throughout the interview. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not registered yet. Just look for the red button on our homepage at macrovoices.com that says looking for the downloads. It's right next to Juliet's picture on our homepage. Juliet, I want to get into a bunch of different topics with you, but where it's an FOMC week, we'll have a listener revolt if I don't start with your take on the FOMC. What'd you make of this week's event?
Okay, so I was here talking about the Fed a few months back, and I don't really think that yesterday's FOMC was groundbreaking. Powell has certainly embraced Mervyn King's advice to be as boring as possible as a central banker. If I wanted to find a best way to put my feeling following yesterday's FOMC conference, I would say that the Fed basically will never hike again. What was interesting about Powell's press conference last night was that he finally acknowledged a fact we actually discussed almost exactly a year ago, which was that the 2018 double tightening via three hikes and QT was a policy mistake. Coming into 2019, he said, "I didn't see, and I don't think anybody saw coming, the challenges that we face this year. I think they were a surprise. Toward the end of 2018, there was still a sense that the economy was growing at around 3%, and it didn't. I didn't expect to face the challenges, but I think we did face them, and I am pleased that we moved to support the economy in the way that we did." So that's what Powell said in the conference last night. So the great thing is that we saw the challenge they were facing ahead. So And that actually brought us the opportunity that we traded this year. The even better news is that they are still thinking linearly, which leaves us plenty of trading opportunities for 2020. So let's see what they think. They are confident about the outlook, and especially in standing pat on rates, allowing them eventually to reach their inflation target in a persistent manner. I think they're wrong on that because the economy reacts to the change in financial conditions, not its level. Therefore, inflation and inflation expectations will continue disappointing, growth will relapse, and they will cut again in 2020. The signal will, I expect, be the US curve re-inverting, global equities just starting to struggle to make new highs, and probably renewed dollar strengths, at least versus EM and commodities.
Okay, Juliet, so despite the passing of undoubtedly the greatest inflation tamer in all history, Mr. Paul Volcker, this week, it seems that, again, inflation is a problem that we as investors need to focus on, and it's not going away. In fact, Christine Lagarde, in the ECB's announcement just this morning, Thursday morning, revealed ECB data that suggests inflation is picking up. Except it is disinflation, according to you, and the specter of deflation that is now hanging above our heads. So, Juliet, can you walk us through your views and maybe help me understand? It seems like you're not at all concerned about inflation. Christine Lagarde, I know whom you have a lot of respect for, has clearly a different view, or at least she's reporting different data, or am I missing something?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that by definition, central bankers have to be cheering on the economy. So, you know, even if she thought there was no chance of ever hitting the inflation target, she would still pretend that it's possible. Otherwise, inflation expectations would basically collapse and inflation would be feeding on itself and collapse as well. So, you know, I'm not expecting that she will be saying what she thinks anymore, even if she actually said the opposite. The one thing with inflation is that it is really important to distinguish between domestically driven forces and global forces. So I'm obviously going to be taking the US here because it's the most interesting inflation picture where a lot of investors still believe that it will pick up eventually. So in the US, underlying domestic inflation pressures, which are best measured via services inflation, excluding energy and shelter, have remained very tame. And you can see that on the chart one of the chart deck I provided. You can see that core services inflation is picking up slowly, but it still fails to match anywhere close to what prevailed at full employment in the past two cycles. Even in this cycle, we're still far from the 3% line, which was achieved in 2016. To add insult to injuries, inflation expectations are actually at all-time lows and still falling. And on this chart, I'm showing the Michigan survey one, but if you look at the New York Fed or, in fact, pretty much any other surveys, you will get exactly the same picture. The problem is that realized and expected inflation expectations are reflexive. They feed on each other. So you really need a real and lasting inflation shock from here to get even close to re-anchor inflation expectations to level consistent with the Fed's target. So that was chart one in my chart pack. If you go to chart two, you can see that the Fed's dramatic U-turn this year has failed to move the needle on the low forever inflation outlook. In fact, for the first time in history, inflation expectations have become completely immune to much easier monetary policy, supposedly. And despite looser monetary conditions this year, inflation risks are still considered totally absent. That's on the chart two of my chart pack. This is partly explained by the Fed's unduly hawkish stance since Powell became chair. Now, I'm not saying they did it on purpose. It's obviously part of the policy mistake. Trump's election certainly fed the American animal spirit, at least initially. And the result was a post-election Fed irrationally afraid of inflation, leading to their unduly hawkish bias. So that was for really the domestic side of inflation. On the goods side, it's a completely different story. With globalization, goods inflation has largely become a global zero-sum game, where the central bank that scores points towards its inflation mandate is the one that basically manages to weaken its currency. So remember, inflation is a solid, up to 18 months lagging indicator. That means companies adjust prices each year according to past cost pressures and their pricing power. And the 2017 dollar fall has been basically the main source of reflation in the US over the past 2 years. So you can see on chart three that unfortunately, the Fed's relatively hawkish stance in 2018, especially compared with its global peers, has meant that the dollar stayed bid in the past 18 months, pretty much. And this will be repaid in the form of lower core goods inflation into 2020. And you can verify that for yourself on chart three, where you can see import price and the dollar in green feeding directly through dollar core goods. And we've had new CPI data yesterday, which is basically showing that core goods is now at zero on a year-on-year basis. And I think we're going to go back to like deflation in 2020.
Juliet, so far we've talked about the U.S. monetary policy aspects of this reflation situation, but isn't China a big part of the reflation equation?
Eric, this is a great question. And in fact, it's one of the key ones. In 2015-16, and in fact, for most of the bouts of reflation we've had in this business cycle, it was China leading the reflation fight. The targeted investment boost through credit floods was the main engine that reflated base metals and eventually saw China PPI move from -5% in 2015 to +8% in 2016-17. And these trends fed directly into US core goods, especially when global reflation actually allowed the dollar to weaken, as what happened in 2017. However, you will see on chart four of my chart pack that China PPI is still in deflation territory at -1.5%. So don't count on China for global reflation this time. Of course, you will ask me what's the difference between, you know, today and any previous episode. The reason China is not a source of reflation this time is simple. Firstly, there is much more awareness amongst policymakers there on the possible downside of credit, and especially private credit, which is a source of future instability and deflation. Secondly, this mini cycle is conscientiously driven by consumption, being stimulated rather than investment. So there is a lot less of a need for base metal and et cetera. And therefore, a lot less of the reflation boost that we've had in the past for the rest of the world. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, there is much less of a propensity to consume and invest in China. So you can observe this for yourself on chart 5. Look at M1 versus M2 collapsing. If you ask me, basically, I think the Chinese animal spirit has been put to sleep, perhaps due to the geopolitical tensions. And the result is that new credits, which is on my chart in orange, look like they're being used to pay for old credits rather than feeding through to higher activity via investment and consumption. So you can see on chart 5 that the green line trending down is the reason the raw industrial index is still hardly off the lows versus the substantial uptrend in the orange line, which is the main difference between what's happening today and what happened in 2015-16.
Okay, Juliet, I promise this will be the last inflation question, and apologies for so many, but this is really fascinating, and I'm intrigued if I'm understanding you correctly. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that global inflation is like a zero-sum game where there's a fixed quantity of inflation to be had in the world, in sort of like competitive devaluation in the 30s. It's like all the different governments around the world are vying for their piece of the pie. You don't get any inflation because we want it over here. We're going to steal your inflation and put it onto our balance sheet. And I guess the way that they accomplish that is by weakening their currency. Am I reading that right? And what are the implications, if so?
Eric, this is another great and absolutely crucial question you ask, which will take me way beyond the answer you expect and go a long way to convince your listeners that US rates are still too high at minimum in a relative way. So given renewed concerns about price dynamic and the ongoing Fed policy review, we do ourselves a huge favor by remembering one key thing, which is that global central banks have equivalent mandates. They're basically all targeting inflation at 2%. But the targets are measured in a completely different way. And for example, that's particularly the case between the two main central banks globally, which are the ECB and the Fed. For example, the Fed's price basket includes a hefty shelter weight that the ECB excludes completely. This quote-unquote shelter is literally the only source of divergence between the Fed's moderate success towards achieving its inflation target and the ECB's apparent complete failure. Shelter measures basically the cost of home ownership, and arguably that's one of the largest expenses in a household. And that's calculated through what some of the economists will know as owner equivalent rent, which is the cost of renting your own house. The ECB completely omits this cost because there is no independent price for it. Far be it from me to open the discussion on what an inflation target should include, but I will tell this. In my opinion, house prices and perhaps even market prices should be included. After all, financial repression's main pitfall is that it pressures real and financial assets higher, ensuring that home ownership becomes a Sisyphean task for new buyers. Meanwhile, pension investment becomes extremely challenging in the process. The bottom line is that shelter is the largest item in the Fed's inflation basket, and it's been the one source of inflation in this business cycle, running above 3% annually since 2015. If you look on chart 6 of your package, you will see that if the Fed's inflation target excluded this component, core inflation would be running around 1% in the US since 2015, and the Fed would have never hiked. Conversely, if the ECB boosted the housing rental component of its own target, which is currently a mere 7% of core inflation, and running at 1.5% annualized, which is higher than where actual European core CPI is, it would probably boost trend inflation by about like 0.4%. So suddenly, the 2% target would not look so unachievable, and keeping rates deeply in negative territory would be very hard to justify for Mrs. Lagarde. The ECB would also struggle to continue arguing that the euro FX rate is a mere input in its economic model rather than a goal in itself. Nonetheless, the consequence is that the ECB has kept the euro artificially 10% undervalued for the past 5 years. And that's something you will be able to see for yourself on chart 7. The corollary is obviously that the euro area trade surplus versus the US has exploded since the respective Fed and ECB monetary policies diverged, with the ECB's negative interest rate policy and QE program, which started from 2014. If the Fed and ECB were using like-for-like inflation targets, their monetary policy stances would not have diverged so greatly after 2014. So the issue is that the euro's distorted valuation has far-reaching ramifications, as you know. It is keeping the dollar artificially strong, as basically the only reserve currency in the world with positive yield. This is in turn depressing the US manufacturing sector. And again, you can see that for yourself on chart 8. If it was just about depressing the manufacturing sector of the US, it would be one thing, but not sort of like the end of the world. The issue, as we must all know by now, is that the dollar strength is also keeping global liquidity unduly tight because it basically devalues non-dollar liquidity, which works then as a dampener on global activity. And that's something you will be able to see on chart 9. Whilst it allows the euro area a larger slice of the global demand cake, the ECB's extraordinarily dovish monetary policy stance also tends to shrink the global cake. And the consequence is that negative rates are not only counterproductive for Mrs. Lagarde and domestically, they are also dragging global activity down. Let that sink in. So putting this divergence between the Europe and US as a side, I would like to go further. In Biarritz on August 23rd, President Macron greeted President Trump with a one-on-one lunch before the G7 summit. In Buckingham Palace at the NATO summit last week, Macron, Trudeau, and Johnson appeared to ridicule Trump over his lengthy press conference. The same way Biarritz marked the bottom in geopolitical tensions, I believe that London will mark a top in the global détente. With the impeachment process ongoing ahead of the next US election, I think Trump needs cajoling. The EU has been free riding on the US in a macroeconomic sense, and I question the wisdom of refusing its leader the deference his country deserves. And I hope the American listeners on the call will appreciate my macro neutrality here. With US trend growth melting, I think that Trump is right to target trade imbalances, and the imbalance with the EU is particularly mind-boggling. The real question is, should the Fed cut to zero or the ECB normalize? Or maybe both? There is no question, however, that the trade imbalance between the EU and the US stems from market distortion and is detrimental to the world as a whole. Together with a review of the tools available to meet its 2% inflation target, I think that Lagarde should probably review the inflation basket itself, and admitting that it is artificially too low would boost the ECB's credibility and allow for a welcome interest rate normalization for European savings and for the world. Will this be a subject for 2020? Perhaps one that even Trump forcibly raises?
Well, it'll certainly be my next question, regardless of what anyone else does. Is 2020 the year when the ECB hikes, or the one when the Fed starts on its descent to zero? So which side of this candle is going to burn first?
So I'm sorry, it's going to be another lengthy answer. Today, Christine Lagarde gave her first press conference following her first ECB meeting as president. And in a stroke of luck, the recent stabilization in European activity has bought us some really valuable time for a deep review of the monetary policy toolbox at our disposal. By the way, monetary policy review is very much a theme for 2020 and one that I've covered at length in this week's paper. So let's see what she has promised. She has promised that every stone would be turned and every option examined. Meanwhile, don't forget that the Fed continues its own monetary policy framework review, planning to report its findings in the first half of 2020. So what's the main reason for these reviews? So excuse me for, I'm going to get a little bit technical here. The neutral level of the policy interest rate, which is the natural level that keeps the economy on an even keel when employment and inflation are close to their objectives. That's the reason for the review. It has fallen globally, and the issue is that the decline of the neutral level of interest rates is very perilous. It increases the risk of hitting an effective lower bound, whether it's zero for the Fed or negative, constraining a central bank's ability to counter future downturns. So let me explain to be very clear. When the neutral rate is even slightly positive, central banks have a lever on the economy. Rates can be cut to zero and financial conditions remain accommodative. In contrast, if the neutral rate dips into negative territory, they completely lose their lever as rates hit their effective lower bound. And automatically, almost, financial conditions can quickly turn restrictive. It can trigger a vicious circle of lower inflation expectations that spikes real rates, triggers lower spending, and eventually turns into higher unemployment and a recession. It's the very definition of a liquidity trap, and the one global central banks are trying to avoid by pushing for a fiscal solution. So the structural neutral rate is directly linked to trend growth, which we have seen in past interviews, is the mirror of employment growth and productivity gains. Unfortunately, for employment growth, the closing of a massive demographic transition, as baby boomers basically leave the workforce into 2030, has taken a dramatic toll in this business cycle. You can see that on chart 10, and I'm sure that's a chart that you've already seen before, but I thought it would be useful to have it here again so we all realize the cliff edge we're basically going through. If you take the example of the US, it's a demographic chronic disease becoming more acute in a late cycle environment. So let's go to the latest NFP release, which had us at fever pitch last Friday. It showed that aggregate income growth has continued its inexorable descent, and it's now at 4.5% versus north of 6% earlier this year. This is despite very robust employment levels and arguably like a strong employment market. But no trees ever touch the sky. Even if you have strong employment, you cannot grow forever. So whether you believe the impressive NFP number or the sluggish ADP number, which basically we had 2 days ago, it's a matter of employment growth declining or diving. And you can see that on chart 11. In the absence of organic economic growth from rising employment and aggregate income, the sad solution, which I want to say I do not condone, is to keep the global capitalism dream alive by pushing the same aggregate income towards more spending and less saving. And indeed, the national savings rate drives the cyclical neutral rate. Unfortunately, for the capitalism Ponzi scheme, with the exception of US corporate leverage reaching new highs, private deleveraging has very much been the name of the game for this cycle. Against conventional wisdom, the result is that public indebtedness is rising too slowly for Keynesian rather than too fast. And it's only just offset private deleveraging. You can see this on chart 12, which basically shows you that government indebtedness and the rise in public debt is just the mirror image of the decrease in private leverage. And that's basically the end of the debt supercycle, taking its toll on aggregate demand. This means that supply-demand imbalances are building, keeping demand pull inflation depressed and weighing heavily on the equilibrium interest rates. The result to date has been disinflation, financial repression, and a demand problem that is, of course, worsened by inequalities. But it doesn't have to be like that. In fact, it shouldn't be. There is a miracle solution. And the logical Keynesian macroeconomic fix is to re-equilibrate final demand through fiscal programs. So I'm afraid government interventionism is the future. And I know you guys won't like it. Also, us Europeans, and especially French, do get it. I mean, you just need to look at how many people are on strike in France to keep the government as involved as possible in keeping their pensions artificially too high. We have not seen the end of this. But the point is, if governments run larger budget deficits to finance social programs or tax cuts, we will see final demand increase, neutral rates being lifted, and central banks' leverage on the economy be restored. So public spending has become a macroeconomic necessity. Yet, in line with our expectation, it's been the biggest macro story in 2019 and promises to gain further traction into 2020. You only have to watch the UK's PM wannabes, Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, blustering to outbid each other with ostentatious promises of post-election spending sprees to realize that it is public austerity that has become taboo. So consensus has largely jumped to the conclusion that the future belongs to fiscal policy, which is largely expected to drive global interest rates higher into 2020.
Okay, Juliet. So your message is essentially that you expect fiscal responses to the macroeconomic challenges that you're describing. How fast do you expect to see those fiscal responses?
So look, we've come a long way to the fiscal side already. Last week, Japan finally pulled the trigger and announced a supplementary fiscal package much bigger than expected. Unfortunately, it's a public investment program that follows October's consumption tax hike, which is going to be a direct hit on final demand. As President Trump learned from his 2018 corporate giveaways, you cannot respond to demand deficiency with a positive supply shock. The same is true in Europe. In Germany, I think the black zero budget is on its way out after the Social Democrat leadership shifted surprisingly sharply to the left about 2 weeks ago. It won't be happening fast, but Germany's political center of gravity appears to be moving to the left. Meanwhile, as climate change mitigation becomes an integral part of the ECB's mandate, there's little doubt that so-called green bonds will facilitate spending. Generally, productive investment programs are useful for shoring up real growth. However, fiscal policies are most powerful when labor slack is the issue, since they directly boost final demand through higher employment. If everybody already has a job, it's much more difficult to get traction on the economy. Near full employment, the short and medium-term effects on demand will therefore be very limited. And lacking demand acceleration, inflation will continue to struggle. Understandably, governments are very reluctant to come out with more contentious measures that might stimulate demand more directly. For example, middle-class tax cuts or direct social spending. And I think the usual motto will apply: if it ain't completely broke, don't fix it. I'm really trying to use my very best British accent here. Government's immediate focus is still to preserve the status quo and keep the liquidity trap at arm's length. People's QE taking over from financial QE is definitely the end game. This is likely to be implemented not via MMT though, and governments printing money at will, but with governments holding an account at the central bank from which funds can be distributed wisely according to an institutional mandate. So keeping inflation on a short leash, basically. However, I think more politically correct plans will be tried first and fail before money is actually printed and distributed. I think in 2020, this gives the ECB and the BOJ the luxury of staying put. But I really do not expect in an L-shaped non-inflationary recovery that it will justify hikes. So for me, this leaves the onus of driving the dollar versus the rest of the world to the Fed.
Okay, Juliet, fantastic macro perspective, and I couldn't agree with you more that helicopter money is going to be the end game here. But now I get to ask you to translate these macro views to actual trading strategies. How do we invest and make money based on this understanding?
Okay, so this is my framework for 2020. While the Fed will keep dragging its feet, I think it's evident that US rates are still too high. If not in absolute terms, at least relatively. Eventually, the Fed will be forced to continue pumping the cycle via further rate cuts into the election. And by the way, that's irrespective of whether there is a China-US deal or not. You know, as we speak, I hear that Trump has yet again come out with some very positive noise on the deal he's making with President Xi. But I think we're very much close to being priced on that, and I don't see much progress on phase two anytime soon. Anyway, to go back to the recommendation, I think really what you want to do is playing the Fed dragging its feet theme via lower breakevens, and I mean inflation breakevens. I think the Fed will eventually be forced to continue with its cutting cycle. So you want to be playing that through long two-year US treasuries. And in terms of the DM rate convergence theme, I think you want to play this through short dollar yen. I would like to have a word as well on euro dollar. The long euro dollar hefty carry really keeps me neutral on euro dollar, you know, especially in risk on markets. But with the euro becoming the borrowing currency of choice globally, I think we're bracing ourselves for a sharp move higher at some point in time of stress. So I would warn your listeners not to be too complacent there and to remember what happened with those borrowing in Swiss franc or even Japanese yen in a few time in history where, you know, your carry gets wiped out in 24 hours.
Now, Juliet, since August or so in your All-Stars appearances with Macro Voices, you have been exceedingly bullish on risk assets, particularly U.S. equities. Is that still your take? If not, what's your take now?
Thanks, Eric, for asking me about equities. There's actually one urban legend that I would like to kill for this asset class. We really commonly hear that equities tend to be the last asset class to price an imminent recession. It's totally true. Equity prices tend to peak less than 6 months ahead of a recession, with the fifth wave of the bull run often actually the most rewarding. But it is completely false to say that equities are therefore a poor recession indicator. And that's for a reason that I will expose now. Basically, equity prices can be decomposed into two components: underlying expected earnings and the valuation multiples that we are willing to pay for those earnings. I think of the equity risk premium as the stock market valuation, assuming constant real rates. So basically, the valuation, assuming no central bank manipulation, if you would like to put it this way. And then I determine late cycle conditions as the period when equity risk premium start rising, signaling a less resilient earnings outlook, while prices continue making new highs on lower real rates and the resulting higher multiples. So if you look on chart 13, in 2000, the ERP signaled the recession a year ahead, and inflation and the last 50 basis point hikes were the kiss of death for the cycle. If you go to chart 14, you can see that in 2007, the ERP signaled the recession 9 months ahead And the Fed was basically caught by surprise by the damages inflicted by the subprime crisis and didn't cut fast enough. A recession resulted. So let's look at what's going on today. On chart 15, you can see that late cycle conditions have prevailed for almost 2 years now, with the blue line trending down whilst SPX and prices are still making new high. Yet there is no signs of a recession. I think really what's going on is that information overload means that households have been preparing for the worst, which explains why private leverage, as in the DM world, been trending down. Sovereign leverage, e.g. public debt, has been rising as a result, but obviously public over private leverage is a source of stability rather than instability, especially now that central banks are equipped with QE and subsequent monetization to deal with the problem. You will also argue that corporate leverage is making new highs in the US, but I think with low rates, it's a lesser evil. And let's face it, if the ECB buys corporate debt, who is to say that the Fed won't do it? So to go back to my chart 15, I think there's one thing I really want to be talking about is that 2018 was about decreasing valuations and lower multiples, and it ended with the December crash. I think 2019 was exactly the opposite of 2018. We've had basically cheap valuation. The SPX equity risk premium bounced off the pre-Trump range lows twice this year. And we've seen cheap valuation and strict financial repression. So the confluence of cheap valuation and increased macro resilience allowed our cyclical tilt since August to generate solid returns. But I'm returning neutral on equities. So why recommend taking profit when the recovery is now just being confirmed? Well, firstly, I expect geopolitical risks to remain elevated. Beyond the first phase of the US-China trade deal, I'm very skeptical that meaningful progress can be made, for example, on forced technology transfers and SOE subsidies. Perhaps rightly, Trump will also intensify the sabre-rattling with the EU, especially as US trend growth continues melting down. Brexit, which is just right now being decided, is unlikely to be plain sailing, even with the best intentions on both sides of the channel. And that's very simply because there is too much at stake. You know, if you only consider like England and France, there is so much at stake that there's no way it can be dealt with quickly. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, I think 2020 will start with an attractive risk asset valuations and already assuming a substantial macro rebound from here. And you can observe that on the final chart of my chart deck. Going back to chart 15, you can see that the cyclical tilt, which happened since August, has taken us back as far as the equity risk premium is concerned to the pre-Trump range highs. And I see very few objective reasons for a break higher from here, unless you somehow believe that the 15% middle class tax cuts are basically imminent. So what I would like to conclude from here, and the reason why I'm going neutral on equities, is that I think that equity gains will most likely result from lower real yields and basically higher multiples from here, which basically favors going long gold rather than staying long equities. So in August, we actually switched out of long gold into long equities to express that belief that we would get the cyclical tilt, and we're going back to long gold and neutral equities. When re-entering, I will also focus more on defensive sector and the US, because the main reason for being long equities would just be basically that the Fed is cutting to zero.
Juliet, I want to come back to your switch back to long gold, because that's very interesting. But even before we get there, you mentioned in your last answer, just in passing, you mentioned the trade deal. Now, just in the time that we've been speaking on Thursday morning, we have seen a massive spike up in both U.S. equities. The S&P broke, as we were speaking, to new all-time highs. And crude oil also broke well beyond its range resistance of the last couple of days, almost taking out last week's high. Now, we've been talking. I haven't been plugged into the news, but I'd be willing to bet that for the 163rd time, we just went from trade deal off again to trade deal on again. And based on the exuberance of the move, I'm guessing that the China trade tariffs on the 15th of December, either the U.S. is backed away from that or has hinted that they might back away from that or something has happened as we've been speaking. I could be wrong, but I'm guessing that's what drove this move. Should we be taking these trade news-driven moves in markets seriously? It's something that I've been really just pondering lately because I think, frankly, that this market obsession with China trade deal is overdone, but it seems like it continues regardless of what I think.
Look, I think we're going to be pricing a lot of good news then this week. I mean, not only, you know, potentially Brexit is going to be now like, you know, is going to come with less uncertainty, well, at least supposedly. You know, the phase one of China-US is widely expected to happen. So I always sort of like saw this week as like the week which is going to be the next sort of like inflection point in terms of market dynamic. But as always, you know, we have to remember that that's the reason why we are here. So making new highs is all part of like at least a short-term topping process, in my opinion. And I think we could keep making new highs, and especially into the end of December, but I just don't see the risk-reward anymore.
Let's come back to gold then and talk about the risk-reward there, because I had been feeling like, as you've said, inflation, in your view, is not as big of an issue as you think a lot of other investors think it is. Now, gold broke through its channel resistance line earlier this morning on the ECB announcement where they described increasing inflation. My prediction was going to be that that would turn into a false breakout, and it looks like I've already been proven right that we've come back down below that trend resistance line. Given your views on inflation, I thought you were going to tell us it's not time for gold yet. Wait it out a little bit longer. You just said the opposite. So help me understand that apparent conundrum.
So, I mean, firstly on gold, you know, with my thinking process and framework, I actually managed to capture, I think it was like 15% upside from the beginning of 2019. For me, gold is basically the perfect hedge for, you know, worrying that inflations are going to be like basically confiscating your money through negative rates. And so we've seen the pool of negative yielding debt going from, you know, going up dramatically into the months of August this year. And for me, that's the main driver for gold. Now, I got out of long gold because of my view that negative rates or further negative rates were not going to be the answer to the next downturn. So I got out of gold and I actually like recommended to short bubbles on that view and picked up the sell-off in rates from August to November. And I think we're basically going back into like a macroeconomic dynamic where, you know, the Fed is going to be the one moving further into financial repression. And that's going to be what potentially keeps driving equity afloat or, you know, potentially even making new highs into next year. And that's the very reason why I like gold again now, e.g., we're out of the cyclical tilt. So that means you can buy the edging asset rather than the real asset that actually you would want to own on, you know, increased macroeconomic resilience. Is that making sense?
That makes perfect sense. And I think that we definitely agree in the long run. There's just no question in my mind that gold is the big winner. What we're headed toward is some kind, I don't know whether you call it MMT or you call it helicopter money or you call it something else.
I don't call it an MMT because I don't think government is going to be printing the money. which is also why I don't think inflation gets out of hand.
But it sounds like we do agree that what's going to happen is the people around the world, and there are more and more of them. We're seeing social uprisings from Hong Kong to Chile to all over the place. Lebanon. I mean, we're getting
totally.
More...
It's going to be people queuing all basically like blood in the street.
And it's such a perfect setup because although it hasn't become a popular politician's meme yet, you know what's coming, which is they're going to say, look, what central bankers have proven over the last decade is that it really is possible for central banks to conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air and to do it without crashing the economy in massive runaway inflation, which is what a lot of people predicted ahead of QE1. Now that it's been proven that this is possible, we need to stop using the money, the trillions of dollars that are conjured out of thin air, and giving them to the rich people. And instead, we need to help the people in need. And that is just such an incredibly powerful and politically tenable message. I know that it is going to take over. Now, frankly, I don't think it's a good idea. I think we're going to find that kind of QE does result eventually in runaway inflation. I think it's going to get really ugly. But at first, it will look to be wildly successful, and I think it will feed on itself. And I think there's a huge amount of helicopter money in some form coming. How could gold possibly not be the big benefactor of that?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen things differently. I mean, that's basically the argument for buying Bitcoin and gold and the fact that, you know, your money gets confiscated. And I just don't see it, or at least not, you know, anywhere on my trading horizon, because I just don't see inflation coming on the back of that. I think basically the problem is with capitalism and the fact that we just have to live with much lower growth. And the way we can live with lower growth is initially by having to fund some of those programs. And, you know, especially like, you know, pension funds is obviously not a problem only in France. It's a problem everywhere in the world. The fact that we've based the system on the fact that we were going to grow forever, which is obviously not the case. So I think I see more like the sort of like people QE as a way to transition to basically much lower growth and much lower consumption.
Okay, and I just want to clarify, because I said three different things there, and then you said, no, wait, I disagree. I said I think helicopter money is the way of the future. I said that I think that will eventually result in runaway inflation, and I said gold has to be the big winner. If I'm not mistaken, the big one that you disagree with is the inflation part, but I think you do agree on the helicopter money, and you do agree that gold is the winner. The issue is just you don't see the inflation risk the way I see it.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't see it as a hedge against inflation.
So if inflation is not the risk, do you think that helicopter money is the right answer and it's something that we should be pursuing aggressively?
I think it's the only answer, because if you've got private deleveraging, you know, it's very intensely deflationary. So if it's not balanced by government spending, you end up in a recession really quickly. So I think it's the necessary transition. And yeah, I completely agree. It's the only way, because, you know, inequalities is obviously one thing that's taken away a huge part of like global demand as well. You know, corporates don't spend the money they put it on an account. You know, if it was paid to workers, suddenly you would have like a lot of demand potential unleashed. And obviously, it's the same between like middle class and the above 1%.
Well, the good news here, Juliet, is we don't need to agree on whether it's a good idea or not, because I think we do very much agree it's coming. And I think that helicopter money, whatever form you want to describe it, is going to happen, and it's going to happen on a larger scale than almost anyone anticipates. Juliet, we're going to need to leave it there in the interest of time, but before I let you go, I want to ask you about what you're up to these days at JDI Research. When I first met you and had you on Macro Voices a couple of years ago, really your only product offering was for our full institutional listener base, large institutions. You were not offering anything to family offices and high net worth individuals and so forth at that time. I believe that's changed. Please give us an update on your product offering and what you're doing at JDI Research.
Yeah, so we have two services, a comprehensive one, which will give you a great understanding of the underlying global macro trends to use as an input into any investment process, really. And we do price differently, you know, whether the institution is big or whether we're talking to a family office or a very dynamic high net worth. Really, our focus is on the transparent tracking of our macro views through clear recommendations, and most importantly, try and cut the noise out and only talk about what really matters to help clients advance in the market. I really believe that one of the reasons so many hedge funds are falling is because of the overload of information and on basically PM's inability to just focus on the underlying trends. For that service, I actually would like to, like every year for the past, actually, I think it's the third year we're talking just before Christmas, I would like to offer a sharp discount for the first 5 Macro Voices listeners who sign a yearly contract with JDI Research. We also have a premium service whereby clients get daily insight into my thought process. This is currently at full capacity, but get in touch if you think you have the arguments to make me change my mind. This would probably imply that you work around Paris, where we're opening an office in 2020, because I want to have more clients in Paris. I really want to finish by wishing you all a great end of year, and I want to thank you, Eric, for allowing me to meet all those great thinkers. I've loved our exchange through 2019.
Well, it's great to have you, and we look forward to having you back in 2020. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have Juliet back on the show. What did you take away from her interview?
Well, it's fascinating. As I've said for many years, the big question is, when is inflation really going to hit the stage? And some people think, you know, here it comes. And obviously, Juliet thinks we're not there yet. So I'll continue to listen to Juliet and as many of the other experts as we have on the show and try to assimilate that. But I want to shift gears now, Patrick, because Zoltan Pozsar, who, for those people who read Danielle DiMartino's Booth, that's the quirky guy who used to work for the Fed that Danielle described as one of the very few people at the Fed who really, really understood the plumbing of how the financial system works. That same guy, who's now with Credit Suisse, had a note out this week that everybody's been talking about. Essentially, what he is predicting, Patrick, is that by the end of the year, we're going to have another significant disruption in the repo markets. It's not over yet. Now, Zoltan Pozsar, we have managed to finally make contact with. We've been sending him invitations for more than a year. He has kindly written back and explained that due to restrictions placed on him by his compliance department, he can't come on Macro Voices. But we do want to discuss this piece, and it's interesting, Patrick, as we put the word out and kind of went through our Rolodex of people who are gurus on the repo market and understand this, an interesting trend emerged. It seems like a lot of people disagree with Zoltan on this one. Most of the people that we're aware of who are experts on this subject don't agree with him, but at the same time, they didn't really want to come on Macro Voices and talk all about it because he's a very prominent guy and they didn't seem to want to disagree with him. But our own friend Jeff Snyder is more than happy to do so. In fact, Jeff wrote a terrific article, the link is in your research roundup email, describing why he disagrees and thinks that Zoltan's story has it wrong. Let's bring Jeff into the discussion now. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us for our postgame segment.
Hey, thanks, Eric and Patrick, for having me back.
Let's go ahead and dive into this. And I want to start, Jeff, with an understanding, if you can help us through this, of exactly what Zoltan is saying, why he thinks what he thinks. And then after we've got that clear, we'll move on to the subject of why you have a different view. Let's start with this. Essentially, what he's saying is that by the end of the year, we're already seeing that this repo madness maybe is not over. And specifically, if you look already, the current rates right now, the spot rate for repo is quite a bit lower than the forward-looking rate if you want repo transactions at the end of the year, what some people call the turn rate in repo. So what is it that we're talking about? What is the risk? Why is it a problem? What are the things that we need to be looking at to understand why the end of the year repo story might be different from the repo story at any other time? I remember from your All-Stars appearance, Jeff, you had explained that there were end of quarter issues affecting the reasons we saw this in September. Is that why the end of the year is important? How does it play in? What's the backstory here before we move into the particulars of what's going on?
Well, I think the best way for me to start is just, you know, let's talk about what Zoltan was writing about. And let me begin by stating up front that, you know, I'm paraphrasing and summarizing what is a very lengthy and highly nuanced argument made by Zoltan. Now, there's quite a lot to it, which I'm sure he feels will be important to understanding the full nature of his position. So I urge you, if you're inclined, read his entire piece if you're able to, and decide for yourself if I'm leaving anything out or mischaracterizing any parts in my summarization of it. His overriding theme is essentially that banks are running low on reserves for a couple of very important reasons. The first one is quantitative tightening, QT. Regulations like Basel III, which have upended the prior order of liquidity settlement processes, which Zoltan spends a lot of time diagramming going over. JP Morgan, which, you know, as the BIS reported recently, the top four U.S. banks have climbed up to become what Zoltan characterizes as the lender of next to last resort. So combining those three things, the distribution of reserves is, I guess, less than ideal. And on top of that, in Zoltan's reasoning, they've been further flattened out with changes to IOER. So those things, along with a couple of additional plumbing factors that he goes over, basically he says there are no excess reserves. Now, that's a problem because in Zoltan's view of everything, reserves are the central focus of every kind of liquidity. So for repo, for FX, or whatever else, it has to be reserves. And if JP Morgan or the other three largest banks don't have any, that's going to be a problem in repo as well as FX, since they act as the effective backstop for both. And that backstop works on spreads. So as we saw in September in the repo market, and a little bit in the FX basis at the same time, these huge, enormous spreads that showed up with the GC rate rising into double digits, it led to nothing. No one stepped in to keep things normal and orderly. So in Zoltan's view, it must be because there weren't enough reserves. Now, the Fed's role was to step in and staunch the bleeding after the fact. They gave dealers like JP Morgan access to some additional reserves, but in Zoltan's mind, they weren't nearly enough. Most of them ended up in the federal government's hands, which then left the state of reserves in the same state as they were before September. Now, what Zoltan's worried about for the year end specifically is the GSIB surcharge. And GSIB is the acronym for Global Systemically Important Bank. It's a government designation of all these large banks that are obviously, as the name implies, systemically important. After the experience of 2008, regulators figured out, obviously too late, that banks are both levered up independently of capital ratios. And Eric, that's something you and I spent a lot of time covering in Eurodollar University Season 2. But these banks are also prone to liquidity shortfalls. Those two things actually go hand in hand. So the GSIB surcharge tests systemically important banks to hold extra liquidity in the form of liquid assets based on their leverage. And they do all sorts of calculations about what that leverage is, and they do those calculations during the year. So the long story short, this year, all the GSIBs except for Morgan Stanley are going to have higher surcharges, and that will clamp down on pretty much everything. And in Zoltan's reasoning, it will leave the FX market in the same bucket as repo, essentially, without any effective backstop, because not only are dealers further constrained as compared to years past, but this GSIB surcharge thing will also change the incentive structure within the market redistribution mechanics. So his big conclusion is, you know, it's the same one he always comes to. Interest rates have nowhere to go but up. He's at least consistent in that regard. He's been saying the same thing for years. Treasury yields, he says, are going to spike with repo rates in the FX basis starting in a couple days.
So, Jeff, what is your view and how does it differ? And where do you see the flaws in the argument, or at least how do you see things differently?
Well, Patrick, I have basically four main objections. And to start with, what he didn't include in his report. And that is how he's done a complete 180 on dealer holdings of U.S. Treasuries. You know, for the last year and a half and even longer, all we've heard about is how dealers are being forced to hold treasuries they don't want. Time and time again, you hear too many treasuries, too many treasuries, too many treasuries. And the fact that Zoltan Pozner had come out and said that very thing along the way gave the idea a lot of credence. It was repeated widely, especially in the Financial Meter, after he wrote about it. And it was totally absurd. You know, Eric and I had talked about this on Macro Voices podcasts quite a few times. You know, the price behavior of the bond market said so. The facts were, as I recently wrote, very stubborn on this issue. The only reasonable conclusion you could have reached was that dealers were choosing to hold so many of those securities. If they wanted to, they could have sold them to the financial public at any time and made an enormous profit for doing so. And now, without explanation, Zoltan agrees. Dealers really have been choosing to hold U.S. treasuries. And that matters for a couple of very important reasons. First, it changes everything from a problem with the budget deficit, which is the reason the dealers were supposedly forced to hold treasuries in the first place, to a more systemic and financial monetary issue. What are the dealers actually telling us about what they are seeing that has made them make a conscious choice to hold all these treasuries, even to the point of contributing to chaos in the funding markets? And it's a question no one asks while the too many treasuries canard remain dominant in the mainstream media. Now, the other important part to pointing out this flip-flop is that it demonstrates the difficulties we are experiencing here. It shows that even Zoltan really doesn't maybe have a very good idea what's going on in the repo market either. You know, this constant changing of stories, like at the Fed, it isn't a positive sign for people who have a good handle on what's actually going on in the repo market. Now, my second objection is that, you know, now that he admits to what all the evidence has been saying, that the dealers are choosing to hold treasuries, he assigns the most ridiculous motivation behind it, that they're essentially front-running the next QE. And if they're doing that, it would be monumentally stupid. To begin with, as the BIS noted in its quarterly review that was just released, the banking system began to turn in this direction late in 2017. So if dealers have been bulking up on treasuries, intending only to sell them to the Fed, then they would have been betting all along on, you know, Jay Powell, who came in supremely hawkish, completely changing his mind away from rate spiking rate hikes into a full-blown QE at some point. That's a lot to depend upon for what's now nearly 2 years. And furthermore, despite the mainstream hype of QE bond buying, it has been at best mixed for bond prices. The empirical evidence consistently shows there's very little relationship between bond prices overall and central bank bond buying. In fact, bond prices rise a hell of a lot more without QE than with it, as 2019 gives us yet another example of that fact. My third objection, Zoltan tends to focus on these bottlenecks themselves. And I know, Patrick, you had a question about that before we were talking off air. Rather than the underlying issues behind them, you know, he always leads further and further astray by focusing on the bottlenecks themselves. And as I said before, these things are perfectly predictable, including the G-SIB surcharge. Everyone knows what they are going to be well in advance. If you are surprised by these things, you're not doing a very good job. You know, in other words, these liquidity low points that are clustered, especially around quarter end and year ends, aren't really the problem. They are revealing what is the problem like they always have. You know, when did Lehman and AIG fail? September of 2008, 2 weeks before the quarter end. When did Bear Stearns nearly fail? March 2008, 2 weeks before the quarter end. What about LTCM? September 23rd, 1998, but it got into serious trouble. Say it with me, 2 weeks before the quarter end. What's interesting about those is not 2 weeks before the quarter end, but why those particular quarter ends? Why did those end up being so disruptive in a way that other quarter ends that sport the same liquidity bottlenecks never did? So there are systemic considerations here, not calendar considerations. The level of bank reserves, I need to point out, was immaterial in all of those too. My fourth objection is, it's a thing that Zoltan never even talks about, but the BIS actually did in its last quarterly review, which is the collateral utility of treasuries. And even then, the BIS got it all backwards, as well as the timing which shows up in their very own data. Now, Eric, you and I, we've covered this all many times before, so I don't want to take up a lot of time talking about the details. But suffice to say, if Zoltan got the dealers wrong and why they were loading up on treasuries in the first place, but now he says it's a choice because they wanted to front run an unreliable bond buying program many, many, many months in advance. Or the other way to think about this is there's just problems in the collateral stream, which is, again, what the BIS data was telling us too. You know, we have to ask ourselves, why did we see previous episodes of a scramble for collateral when there were supposedly abundant reserves? Why did we see repo rate spikes for years when the deficit was slowly declining rather than expanding? And so, you know, we have a pretty lengthy history to fall back on that shows that it's not the calendar issues. It's not even these specific G-SIB surcharges or bank reserve regulations and all of the kind of things that you wrote about in the report. It's the same liquidity problems that we've observed time and time again.
Now, Jeff, just yesterday, you wrote a piece going into more detail than we have time for on the podcast on this very subject. It was titled, Dealer's Choice, Repo Facts Are Indeed Very Stubborn Things. Listeners, you'll find the link to that in your Research Roundup email. So it's clear that you and Zoltan have very, very different opinions as to why we're seeing problems in the repo market, what's causing them, and how to correctly interpret what they mean. But I think there is agreement that we are seeing repo rates increasing, and particularly at the end of the year. Now, with respect to the consequences of that, what you are seeing, Zoltan's interpretation is, okay, this means there's really only one outcome, which is QE4 is going to have to happen. The Fed's hand is going to have to be tested somehow. We're going to have to get to QE4 in order to solve this. Do you see those conclusions, or is it a completely different story?
Yeah, I think the only thing Zoltan and I agree on is that the Fed has no idea what it's doing and that it's probably going to end up in that place just by default because it doesn't know what else to do. And I think one of the main criticisms that I actually agree with is that the Fed is always behind the curve. They don't see these things in advance, even though they should. You know, repo markets outside of their primary responsibility, but that's something they should consider changing. And so there is definitely things going on. There's definitely liquidity problems out there in the global dollar system. And that eventually, because they don't know what else to do, this is me talking, not Zoltan, because they don't know what else to do, of course, they're going to do quantitative easing. If it gets to a certain threshold, and we have no idea what that threshold will be, that's what every central bank does. They go running back to QE.
And with respect to the U.S. dollar, this is all part of the dollar squeeze theory that you've had. So I would assume that you see this as putting further squeeze pressure, and therefore the, you know, the direction of the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies is ultimately up as the resolution to this. Is that right? And it seems like that may be at odds with other views.
Yeah, and we talked about this earlier this week that a lot of people have said, okay, the dollar's rise is over. It's fallen for the last couple of months, and that presages a change in trend when it's just, you know, that's the way things go. This is a short-term counter trend that develops in any kind of market. So if we do have liquidity problems in the global system over this next turn, I don't see how that doesn't contribute to the same negative pressures that have pushed the dollar higher for now going on 2 years.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us in our post-game segment to cover this important topic. It'll be very interesting to see what year-end actually brings us. Today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, published on September 7th, 2019. The link is in your Research Roundup email. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com for your free account. Please do so. The benefit to you is that you will receive our free Research Roundup email, which provides links to all of the best free research we can find on the internet each week, including download links for our own feature content. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
So this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart book for Juliet's presentation. There's also the link to the article from Zoltan Pozsar about the countdown to QE4 that we discussed here in the postgame. There's also an interesting link to the Jeffrey Gundlach interview, the Fed is cheerleading inflation higher, as well as an interesting article discussing Ken Griffin and having another money machine to rival a hedge fund. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.